session number 11486, rule 7.
To get through that, something would happen. And there was an outer force, in a sense, the fear of air raids that kept people there. Yes, it was a sort of real climax, and one thought about it at the time a good deal and told the tale, and like so many things in the war, everybody talks about their particular experiences at the end, and it took everybody differently. I suppose we had really a pretty easy time of it. We had all the heavy bombing, but when it came to the actual occupying, we had it comparatively easy.
Because this was March, and there was still some time to go before the end of the war, wasn't there?
Oh, yes. The other part of the town, there was between our part of the town, Sterkrade, and the main town, Oberhausen, there was a canal and a river. And they simply came to halt there, and it took them another 10 days to take the other part. We always said the Americans don't believe in losing people. If they can do it slowly, why shouldn't they? I suppose it was some maneuver they made. They probably encircled something else and didn't bother to cross there. But yes, there was that. And even then you could still hear shooting in Essen, which was only something like 10, 15 miles away or so. It quite slow. I think the Ruhrgebiet was encircled, and they then took their time to take it completely. And I suppose, against all expectation, it wasn't defended, really. It was Goebbels, in one of his last broadcasts, said how disappointed he was in the population, that nobody was fighting. Shame upon us, as it were. And we all feared that we would be defended. Nobody wished to be defended, but we weren't. So it all went quite smoothly, really.
And how soon did it take for the military government, you know, to set itself up?
Very swiftly. In fact, the English lady I mentioned before, a friend of my mother's, was contacted, I don't know how, she made herself known to the incoming military government, and she wondered whether I would be prepared to do some interpreting. And that was already in May. In fact, it was before we had an armistice. And I was quite happy to do that. I didn't speak much English in those days, really. I almost needed an interpreter to understand them. I'd done more French. And I should think they came within a few weeks, set up a little office, and there was a lieutenant, a Bobby, and a private, William Roberts, I remember him, very friendly, from Lancashire, and I, and we had our little office, and they weren't allowed to speak in a friendly way to me, because of course this was strictly anti-fraternization, or give me anything at all, and a gun had to be in the same room, a rifle, so that they would be protected. And we all thought it was very funny, and we made out certificates, and if I think about it, I feel very ashamed, because we had a lot of people coming, Poles and Russians and the displaced people who had children or wanted to get married or someone had died, and they needed certificates. And I made them out. I typed them. I had never typed. I had no experience of office work at all. And none, nor had the other two. And we just wrote this out and gave it to them without any record being kept at all. So when later on our office was moved to the main town, they said, "Where are all your files?" And we said, "What files?" And nothing was there. So if they ever lost their certificates, there's no replacements. But that's really a minor matter. That's right. And once the main town, part of the town, was taken. Military government moved there, I suppose, end of May, and I went as well and continued working for military government.
What was the name of the English lady?
Frau Fleischer.
Fleischer,
yes. And she was from Oxford, spoke a beautiful Oxford accent, and so did her children. She herself didn't work for military government, but it was quite interesting. She could always give you a slant on the people. When you have entirely, if you have foreign people come, you don't really quite know their background, their education, and she would place them in their rank order, as it were. She would say, oh, he's so-and-so, he's so-and-so, and that would give one a sort of idea, a bit of background, which was quite good to know.
Sounds like a sort of female Professor Higgins, doesn't it? Well, what did you think of the British compared with the Americans? You know, you seem to have had a very favourable impression of the Americans. I wonder what you thought of the British. Before the FAU, by the way, we're talking about.
Well, I... No. The American troops were friendly. The British troops who then came weren't. Not that they did anything nasty, but they were rather stuck up and not very pleasant, I thought. There were the East Lancs and the Black Watch who came. Particularly the officers with whom I only had to do in military government, very much d'ombre. The officers at military government I worked for were actually mainly Canadian, strangely enough. I found the other ranks and the sergeants much friendlier. Well, it was really particularly the Canadians was really quite a new world. They were different from the British, easier going. I worked for a major there who did labour relations. They were all trying to get you to bed, but almost all of them, most certainly with quite some local success.
Was that sort of helped along with their supplies, do you think? Could they give gifts? I know this happened in England.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, cigarettes, of course, mainly, which were currency, really. You either paid in marks or you paid in cigarettes, almost, particularly on the black market. Yes, it did. And I remember a relatively shameful episode where some officer came and he asked me for a meal, and that was a little later on. I was relatively hungry, and I thought I accepted it and knew precisely what he wanted, and I had the meal and I went, which absolutely infuriated him. But this is the sort of episode that happened. Well, one worked. There was some hypocrisy, something rather which one despised a little. At the time, there was non-fraternization, and there were courts for the soldiers who had fraternized, had been found out. Well, I know that the officer in charge of the court, he was fetched by his driver from a German house out of the bed of a girl every morning. This sort of struck one as slightly hypocritical at the time, but it's sort of post wartime, you sort of thing happens in every army, and if all that happened, it's not really such a terrible thing. I suppose one's opinion didn't improve on closer acquaintanceship then. One came up against those things like, well, some hypocrisy, and I suppose, not an awful lot of culture. And callousness in some respects. But that was all. That was sort of really on a personal level. They were perfectly, really perfectly correct. There was nothing dreadful happening. I think they all enriched themselves by buying things with their currency and their cigarettes. No doubt they did. But, well, sort of you expect that. You wouldn't really quibble over things like that. It seems to me almost inevitable in an army.
How important was the black market?
All important. Because that by that time, we had very few rations at all. It was a few grams of fat a month. So in order to survive, you had to go on the black market. And what I earned in a month bought a pound of butter. We had a big garden that helped. One knew people, one bartered stuff, and I could get hold of cigarettes, of course. So they helped. I had a midday meal provided through military government, which was an enormous help. And people sold and bartered everything they had. They always said, the farmers had their houses sort of lined with Persian carpets because they still had some stuff, and food was all. It was a question of survival, and yes, a big black market.
And how about clearing up the town? You know, you've explained so well how the streets were sort of shut off from each other. Who actually cleared up the rubble and got your life back to near normal?
Oh, that was Germans. After all, they couldn't. The factories only gradually started working again, and not at all. People cleared away their own houses in front of their own houses and made things passable, and that was German labour somehow, and it happened. I don't know whether people got paid. It didn't seem to sort of matter, payment. Question what they got for it, I suppose, really. It was all uneven, but it was passable, and you life continued.
Were there no sort of joint efforts, no organised efforts to clear rubble?
They probably were. I wasn't involved in them. I remember the first thing that we got back was electricity, because it's obviously easiest, of course, after, I don't know, a couple of months, something like that. Of course, one was far less dependent on electricity in those days, and it was summer, there was no heating. And then water came back, and that took 3 months, and we had to carry water from a well sort of a few hundred yards away, all the supply of water. That was the worst. One really does depend on water. And gas, so that was, I don't know, half a year, so didn't seem to matter that much. We cooked by gas, but we had this other range, and we cooked on that. You could live quite happily without gas. Yes, I'm sure there were efforts by the town to clear things up. And a lot of German women did. And in fact, nowadays, if you are a certain age, you get an automatic year allowed for you in your pension as a rubble woman. The ghastly expression. Eine Trümmerfrau. Because you're deemed to have helped, whether you have or not. They now, of course, make it simply if you were born, I think, not later than 1921 or something like that. But I wouldn't have qualified for that, nor did my sister, but that is so, because women did an enormous amount of work. And surprisingly, even in all that upheaval, there were still people who voluntarily helped clear up in the monastery there was, or nunnery rather, and the church. There was a Catholic church and nunnery very heavily hit, and people still gave extra time for that to clear up. They did.
Were there any conflicts in the population so far as you knew? You know, I was thinking of the sort of party members and who had perhaps not fled and were still in the area, and whether there was any retribution at all with the various groupings. Were you aware of any?
Not within the population that much. Some people had fled and they in time came back, but I mean they fled for various reasons. They needn't have been Nazis at all. And of course the German population was so distributed into all four winds, women there and husbands somewhere else and perhaps children evacuated. It was a huge sort of travel home with cart and horse and on foot right through Germany from east to west and west to east. Were like a migration of peoples, really, until everybody wanted to get back to base. And conditions were so poor that I think one concerned oneself really rather with how one was going to survive. And also there was then an authority that sought to sorting out the Nazis. After all, the denazification started. And so there was a sorting out process that happened. So in my recollection, there wasn't anything that happened. I also suppose that the local Nazis kept a low profile.
Did people denounce them ever, do you know?
I'm sure they did. In fact, everybody denounced everybody else, just like you read now in France. I mean, personal scores being straightened out, as it were. I'm sure that happened. Letters came to military government. I suppose I didn't get those, but I suppose they were looked into and records were checked. And then, of course, everybody had to fill in a Fragebogen, a big questionnaire on which organisations they'd belonged to, Nazi organisations. There were, I don't know, 100 or so. But because everything was called national socialistic, if you were tennis club, you joined a tennis club, you were automatically in the National Socialist Sport Association or so. You didn't even know. I mean, that was just standard. So you filled in the questionnaire on whether you'd been in occupied territory and all sorts of things like that. And everybody had to fill this in, but you filled this in for the for military government. And were then put into a class of war criminality or not.
And you know, did anything happen to the known Nazi supporters?
I think to begin with, they probably were put in jail. I didn't know anybody who'd been a real high-up person who would be put before a court. So the smaller fry probably were a bit in jail and ran around and weren't allowed back in their jobs until they were all sorted through. So to begin with the teaching, they would take the only few people who hadn't been in the party, as it were, and then enlarge it a bit. And they went through every organisation like that. If you wanted to study, you had to fill in a questionnaire. They forgot to give me one, military government, so I filled it in after a while. There wasn't anything, obviously. I mean, everybody belonged to the Hitler Youth, which obviously you had to fill in. No, I can't remember there being actual German retribution from German to German at that time.
Going to the end of the war, did you hear about Hitler's suicide? You know, was that broadcast, his death, and the whole series of suicides in the bunker?
After, of course, the war was over by that time, yes. So we had that through official channels, somehow or other, American or Allied, or so what was allowed to be broadcast to us. To begin with, there wasn't any radio for us, so we weren't allowed to have it or something. But that we heard officially, yes. But it somehow didn't affect us anymore, of course. It came with Roosevelt died at about that time as well, and we heard that. That must have been about March or so.
April, wasn't Yes, I think it was about 8.
But it was about the same time, wasn't it? We heard that from the Americans. It was just one thought, good heaven. I personally thought, what a pity he hadn't been caught. But I don't know what other people thought. One was, by that time, it simply wasn't, his life wasn't important anymore. Because the war was over, so obviously. And he was dead and he would die somehow or other.
Did you hear much from Hitler, you know, towards the end of the war? You were explaining how you heard Goebbels would have a go and tell you all that you weren't doing your stuff. Did Hitler broadcast?
No. In fact, he spoke less and less. Goebbels was actually a good speaker. And he would speak more convincingly, as it were. He would produce his points rather cleverly. He was a good propagandist. And he spoke rather excellent German. So his speeches were really quite interesting to listen to, simply because they were really quite clever. So if you knew it would all be lies, then you were interested to see how he'd cover it all up and how he'd present his lies. I think even listened to him speaking since, you know, the odd time you can hear an odd broadcast, and I thought, well, yes, it's really quite fascinating. In a sort of lesson in propaganda, in entirely different style from Hitler. No, I can't remember hearing him in the end. I'm sure he didn't.
When did you hear about the death camps? You know, you were just telling me earlier about your knowledge or lack of knowledge of what happened to the Jews.
Then, it came out then, as the Allied troops went into those camps. It then came out gradually. Even then, I suppose, numbers weren't known. That whole knowledge only developed gradually. And it seemed sort of immeasurable. I mean, you just couldn't comprehend all those millions being killed. It was incredible to believe. Obviously, the pictures were shown and the figures were... But you, in fact, I think if they say 6 million or 4 million, it affects one less than seeing a picture of two completely starving children or adults. That makes, in fact, far more impact. By the time it comes to a million, you can't imagine it anymore, take it in. So, yes, that came out. That came out then.
How did that impress you, you know, when you heard about the camps? You know, was it a shock?
Yes, it was. It was an awful thing. But I find, at the time, so much horror had happened. It took some time to sink in. I think it sort of over the years affected me more. And I've taken sort of more notice of it, possibly living in England, where it's talked about a great deal. Then at the time, there was so much horror, you could sort of not take it in all. There's a certain defence mechanism comes up, and you think, well, let's finish this thing first, and then the next horror. I think this is how it came. We weren't made to go and see a film of it. I think in some towns near these camps, the population was made to see the film. We weren't. I saw one or two people at military government who came through. They were actually Germans who'd been to concentration camps. And I think they wanted some aid or something or other. So I talked to them. They weren't in the category of the very staff. They seemed relatively ordinary, but they'd been there, which impressed one.
When you look back to the war, you know, and your experience and the places you travelled to, do you think there was any evidence that this was going on, that perhaps you didn't pick up and might have done? Were there any clues?
Well, I, I thought about that a good deal, and I lived in an environment where my parents were anti-Hitler, and one picked up all the news. It was never mentioned on the foreign broadcast because they obviously didn't know about it. I suppose people thinking of where have those Jews gone might have picked it up, but then there were in each town only a certain number. After all, they were collected from the whole continent of Europe. It isn't that a whole town was suddenly halved in population. There were only one or two. I suppose that was the one thing, where have they gone? Well, I think it, in parts of it said they're going to camp, some camps to work, and one saw the of war working, so one thought, well, they're in work camps, if one thought about it a lot. Their property was confiscated. I suppose one knew that, but that, well, it didn't impinge. Besides, that's a different matter. That's quite a different sort of scale of things, isn't it? Can always be restored, property. I don't know whether some people could have known more about it, who lived closer, or who had something to do with furnishing materials for those camps. I suppose that's possible. But it is surprising what a dictatorship can do if they really want to keep it secret. You can even keep a whole big camp secret. You can say it's a military installation and nobody's allowed near, and one wouldn't. So it's... I genuinely think that the German population didn't know of the Holocaust going on. That's quite a different matter from saying they ought to have made it their business to find out. I don't know how they could have done, but that's obviously a question to answer. I never knew anybody who had anything to do with it. I suppose the people who did wouldn't talk about it, but I don't know. Apparently, if you read reports now, even the most vile commandants were perfectly pleasant fathers and husbands at home, and the wives might simply think they're somewhere on the Eastern Front.
Was there any re-education programme? You know, attempts to de-indoctrinate German youth, you know, or even adults?
I suppose there must have been. There was a lot of propaganda about democratic institutions, and they were, of course, immediately started in a small way. Schools, I suppose they started with teachers. They sorted them out very carefully. And I think the thing...